Hello and welcome to Broadway Radio's This Week on Broadway for Sunday, April 1st, 2012. My name is James Marino, and in the broadcast this afternoon, we are talking with Michael Portantier and Peter Felicia. Michael is a writer and photographer. You can see his writing and his photography at BroadwayStars.com. You can see his photography at FollowSpotPhoto.com. Michael also writes for outlets like the Sondheim Review and NPR. Good morning, Michael.
Good morning.
Also with us is Peter Felicia. Peter is a writer. You can see his writing at the Newark Star Ledger. He also writes for Masterworks Broadway on Tuesdays, for Kritzerland on Fridays, and at the on the MTI blog at various points during the month. Good morning, Peter.
Hi.
Hi. With us this morning, we have Terrence Blanchard, who is an acclaimed musician who has more than 29 CDs to his credit, is a multi-winner in Grammy Awards, has been recognized in all sorts of mediums, from film and television and recording and live performance. And he's joining us now from his hotel room in Florida, where he's on tour. Mr. Blanchard, good morning.
How you guys doing?
Oh, doing great. Thank you so much for getting up on a Sunday morning and joining us to talk about Streetcar Named Desire. You're writing the score for this this upcoming Broadway show, which is opening at the Broadhurst Theater on April 22nd. This is the Streetcar Named Desire with starring Blair Underwood and Daphne Ruben Vega. So tell us how is the project going for you?
Well, I mean, it's an amazing process. I mean, we're a little under the gun. We got we booked the theater in a way where we didn't have much time to rehearse. But, I mean, everybody's coming together, man, and it's going to be a great production.
That's great. You also did Motherfucker with the Hat, the score for that as well. Is that correct? Oh, wow. And as well as being out on tour and doing all the other things and scoring movies and everything, you're also you've been commissioned to do an opera with the Opera St. Louis.
Yeah, I'm currently working on that, too. It's an opera about a fighter named Emil Griffith, who was a welterweight champion in 1965.
It's when do you have time to do all this stuff? You're a very busy man.
That's the same question I keep asking every day. But I mean, it's prioritizing.
Emil Griffith, the boxer. I recall a fight with Benny the Kid Perrette. Am I correct?
Yes.
I have to admit, I don't remember which one of them survived that fight. I know one of them died.
Benny Perrette was the one that died. I mean, the reason why we're doing the opera, well, for me, I've been a big fight fan for a number of years, and big fan of Emil Griffith's, too. And, he was a man who never admitted to being gay, but a lot of people speculated that he was gay. And in the press conferences before that fight, Benny Perrette, called him Mighty Cone, which is a very derogatory term.
Yeah.
And Emil, in the fight, hit him 17 times with no response from Benny. Benny fell. I went to a coma for 4 days and then died. But the interesting thing about, the Emil's life is that, there was an autobiography done. It was called 9, 10, and Out. And in the book, that's what got me. He said, I killed the man and the world forgave me. He said, but I loved the man and the world could never forgive me.
Huh, that is fascinating. I remember seeing the fight. It was on a Friday night on NBC, and I remember afterwards thinking, wow, we actually have seen a murder on TV. So I was pretty fascinated by that. It really was pretty grisly because, that's even before TV saw Lee Harvey Oswald shot.
That's the interesting thing about boxing. Benny was always a consummate professional. And as a matter of fact, he carried that burden with him for a number of years. And there's a documentary about his life where he actually meets the son of Benny Perrette. And, that's one of the things about boxing. People understand that there's a chance that people can get seriously hurt. and that's why the refs have to do their job. And actually, the son told Benny in the documentary, the family harbors no ill will toward you. And when the son told Benny that, he cried like a baby. And you can tell he'd been carrying the weight of that event on his heart for a long time.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Wow. How did Streetcar happen? Did you know Emily Mann? Did she contact you? Was she the one who wanted you?
It was actually Stephen Bird who called me at first. He was a producer. And he put us together with Emily, and once I met Emily, you know, we clicked right away. Actually invited those guys down to New Orleans to come experience the city and the culture. Basically had to beat them out of the city to get them out of that city.
I believe it. I believe it.
But it's been a great process working with them. I mean, you know, they've been doing a lot of work, like I said, in a short period of time. You know, but they, you know, it's coming together greatly too.
Yeah, that was interesting that you said that because I know the production was mentioned quite some time ago, but then it seemed like it might not come together this season because of, you know, theater availability and blah, blah, exactly. blah. So when did you actually start writing?
Well, I had been coming up with ideas when we first started talking about the project.
Okay.
But like anything else, you know, it's a fluid process, so Emily and myself had a few concepts about what the music should do and how we should approach it. But, you know, once she started getting into the theater and actually working with the actors, you know, things start to change, and that's only normal. So right. There are a couple of things that we, you know, we're moving around and repositioning right now. So, but it's all going to work out. It's going to be great.
I would say Streetcar is probably the most famous play set in New Orleans that I could think of. Were you aware of the play, you know, from an early age?
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
You know, there's the Tennessee Williams Foundation in New Orleans that has a small festival every year, you know, in his honor.
Right.
And, I mean, and the thing about it, you know, the thing that's always fascinated me about the story is when you read the script, I mean, living in New Orleans, you know, I would constantly laugh reading the screenplay because you can tell that the city had a profound effect on him, just like it has on many other people, you know, and it's the reason why he gave us this gem of a work.
Right. It's interesting that Alex North, who wrote the music for the movie version, and I don't know if he wrote it for the play. Actually, I don't know that. But his music is on Broadway now in Death of a Salesman.
Oh, right.
And the other thing that I don't know if people even remember this, but I don't know if you ever saw the TV version of Streetcar with Anne Margaret and Treat Williams. The music for that was written by Marvin Hamlisch.
Really?
Yeah. You know, there's a really nice song in it called Till the Blues Get Gone.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it's beautiful. You might want to check it out sometime.
So, Terrence, you live down in New Orleans with your wife and four kids. My wife and my kids, we were just in New Orleans on Fat Tuesday a few weeks ago. Not the best place to bring a 4 and 8-year-old, you know?
Well, yeah, you know, it's funny. Yeah, not in the French Quarter.
Yeah.
There are other places for kids to enjoy the parades, but not in the French Quarter.
Yeah. But how old are your kids? Are they taking up music as well?
I have four kids. One son and three girls. My son is 24. My three girls are 20, 14, and 13. Uh-huh. My son is doing this thing, writing. He's a vocalist and a songwriter. And my 14-year-old is playing piano. And the other two are my 20-year-old, man, you know, she's in college, and she just told me the other day that she's committing to becoming a producer in the field of journalism. That's what she wants.
Wow.
Which is great for me because we were trying to figure out what was going to happen with her while she was in school. So I'm glad she committed to something. And 13-year-old, she's really brilliant, too. She's very artistic, always painting, creating stories, doing her thing.
Is your wife artistic as well?
In her own right. You know, she's actually my manager and does all of the business. But, you know, she was a journalism major at University of Maryland and worked at ABC Television for a little bit and then worked at Columbia Records. And she actually can write extremely well, but it's just something she doesn't pursue.
The whole vibe in New Orleans, my kids came back just very musical. I mean, they were musical before, but it's just ironic how much music is infused in society down there, and how much we need music education to be funded and continued.
Well, exactly. I mean, you know, it's one of the things I've been a big proponent for because, you know, if there's anything that shouldn't be taken out of the schools, it's the arts.
Yeah.
Because the arts have an overwhelming impact on people's general well-being. I mean, it was even proven under the Clinton administration. He had done a study about that, and they found that kids who studied music and art did much better in math and sciences in school.
Yes.
You know, so I think it's important for us to recognize the power of art and the way that it makes people come together in ways that are socially acceptable. That's the thing that I've always loved about music, because when I was a kid growing up in New Orleans, I met people in my civic orchestra and my civic jazz bands that I never would have met in any other situation.
Yeah. So you're on the road and you're very busy. Are you going to be able to get up to New York for the opening?
I may not be there for the opening because I'm going to be on tour.
Okay.
But I'm definitely going to, you know, come up, you know, before then, probably for one of the previews. I'm actually going to be there tomorrow, you know, working with Emily and the actors.
Oh, that's great. Great. Well, thank you so much for giving you a few minutes out of your Sunday morning. We very much appreciate it, and much success for you in the future.
Thank you. Thank you. I appreciate you guys giving me a chance to talk about the project. I'm excited about it.
Great. You have
hey,
a good day.
I love you. Bye-bye.
All right, man. You guys
bye. Bye-bye. All right. That was Terrence Blanchard with a waking up on a Sunday morning to talk with us about Streetcar. This week on Broadway, we also had an opening of Jesus Christ Superstar. Peter and Michael both got a chance to see it. So, Michael, why don't you start us off with Superstar?
Well, I thought that musically it is an excellent production. And so I was very, very happy with it. And actually, I brought an old friend of mine who had directed a production that I wasn't actually in it. I did the lighting for it years ago. And we had a great time. I don't think you'll ever hear it sung and played better. I believe it's not a very large orchestra, but it's so well mic'd and mixed. I should mention right off the sound designer is Steve Canyon Kennedy, and the musical director and supervisor is Rick Fox. And really, you know, it just was very impressive from a musical standpoint. Paul Nolan, who plays Jesus, I did not really like his acting interpretation very much. He went the route of playing Jesus as very kind of noble and almost impassive from all of the show, really, almost. And I think that works to a certain extent, but there are several scenes where he should get fired up, and I didn't really see that a lot. But again, he sang just great. You know, I mean, Gethsemane is an infamously difficult number, but he did a superb job with it. And the rest of the score too. The Mary also a similar situation. I really did not like her acting at all. I guess it was a choice, but she always seemed to me to be like she was trying to always puzzle things out, and so she seemed confused and like I guess mildly annoyed at some places. But I never really saw her love for Jesus, and I think that's very, very important. So I don't know how much of that responsibility for that choice is hers and how much is Des McAnuff's, the director, but I thought that was a mistake. But again, she sang her one solo, I Don't Know How to Love Him, just beautifully, as well as the rest of her role, which I guess is limited to Could We Start Again Please, a really beautiful song that was not on the original album, but I think was instated for the original Broadway production. And then, of course, she also sings Everything's All Right. And that's pretty much it for Mary, but she sang it beautifully. Now, The Night I Went, which was a critic's performance, Josh Young, who plays Judas, was out. And I hear, I'm sorry to hear, he's apparently been missing quite a bit. That role can be a voice killer if you don't sing it exactly right, and it seems like maybe he's not. So I'm concerned about that. I hope he's okay. It's really one of those shows like Chess, the role of Freddy in Chess, and well, you know, Rent can also be a voice killer. Some people don't seem to know how to sing rock on Broadway 8 times a week without doing kind of some serious damage. And it is obviously a challenge. I hope that's not the case here. But his understudy is Jeremy Kushner, who is also, I believe, the understudy for Jesus. And Jeremy Kushner, many of us may know as the original Wren in the Broadway version of Footloose. And he's has several other Broadway credits over the years. I was a little surprised when I read that he was the understudy here, rather than actually having either of the two roles. But I think it was probably a very wise thing. He seems to be going on a lot, as I said, and the fact that he's not going on constantly perhaps also helps him to preserve his voice. But let me tell you, it was thrilling. He sang it in a way that, it didn't sound like it was hurting, I'm happy to say, but it was very, very exciting. There's a few places in particular where Judas has these incredible high notes, you know, probably like high B flats, you know, held for like, I don't know, like 8 measures or more. One of them comes in the middle of actually of Everything's All Right. And when he hit that note, I literally had chills up my spine. It was thrilling. So I would go I would try to go see Jeremy Kushner in the show if you can work that out. But aside from that, as I said, it musically was great. Directorially, I had a lot of issues with it. It was one of those shows where as each minute went by, I would say, oh, that's a really great, smart idea. And then the next minute, I'd say, well, you know, what's that all about? That doesn't really help at all. One of the positive things was that Mackenough did things like in the opening number, Judas's number, Heaven on Their Minds. Normally, he's alone on stage and just kind of soliloquizing. But here, he sang the whole first section of it, the first half of it, I would say, to Jesus. And that seemed to kind of help to establish their relationship early on. And then later on in the show, there were actually quite long sections where Judas is gone. But Mackenough brought him on like to sort of be observing from the sides. And he also did one neat little thing where right before I Don't Know How to Love Him, it's actually Judas who sort of puts Jesus to sleep, tucks him in, as it were. And then Mary, you know, sings the song to him. So this production, I would say, focused on the love for between Judas and Jesus. And I think that really helped. There were a lot of things production-wise. There were all these LED, I guess, there are projections on various parts of the set about what day it is, you know, Good Friday, you know, 1 week before Lent, things like that. And I don't know, I suppose that helped, but it, but there were also times when it felt sort of distracting. And there's a lot of, you know, I mean, Superstar has always been a mashup between the biblical and the modern. The movie is famous for mixing that. I think they do it actually quite well in the movie, except for the title song, which they did is in ultra disco fashion, which I don't think really works, but that tends to be the choice anyway. So here there were a lot of the costuming. There was a lot of costuming that I would say was kind of over the top and just various decisions that on Mackenough's part that didn't work. But I think, you know, I mean, certainly the story is so compelling to begin with, and musically they did such a fine job that I would highly recommend it. I went into this production with trepidation, but I was very, very happy with it.
Okay, Peter, what did you think?
Well, I was very excited at the beginning to see Heaven on His Mind being done with Judas interacting with Jesus. Suddenly I thought, wow, this is something new. Mm. This is great. You know, and first off, I think that is one of the great opening songs in Broadway history. It's a phenomenal melody. And but the thing is, because it was written for Judas and Judas alone, it gives Jesus nothing to do. What he has to do is simply listen. What I really wish had happened is that Andrew Lloyd Webber and Tim Rice had thought of that from the beginning and had Jesus interact. But the problem is that with Jesus just listening and not saying anything, that he's not engaged by Judas's warnings at all, it almost seems like he's half listening, especially the way this actor plays it. You know, there's a lyric in the show, "One thing I'll say for him, Jesus is cool." Actually, "One thing I'll say for this Jesus, Jesus is cold." He, Michael, I agree with you there. Aloof. I missed was charisma. I mean, this is supposed to be Jesus Christ. This is Jesus Christ, you know, and the thing is, you know, we're told that this guy certainly inspired millions, and, you know, this is not the type of guy who seems that way. He seems like a busy executive who just doesn't care. So it's a double-edged sword at the beginning of this show, because it is a great idea to have him warn Jesus, but not if Jesus can't say anything, because he just seems uncaring.
Right.
He seems to be in a world of his own, quite removed from every... I mean, at one point I thought of Emery's famous line in Boys in the Band. What's he had, a lobotomy? I mean, you know, it just seemed that way to me. So, on the other hand, let's be fair. This is the last week of this man's life. He does have a lot on his mind, have it on his mind in a certain way, you know, substantially more. So I guess, you know, one could make a case for that. Yeah, and, you know, after all, it's Jesus Christ Superstar. And given the fact that we are dealing with a technological production, you know, with a lot of electronic lights going on, and especially during the whipping, a lot of lights, that type of ribbon thing that goes across, like you see in Times Square with the news, is a lot of that. We also get what day of the week it is in lights and all that kind of business. So since it's technological, I imagine with the word superstar and all that, they are trying to point out the fact that Jesus was a superstar, and superstars today do tend to be aloof. I mean, you know, you look, if there's a picture of a rock group, the average picture photo, the average 8x10 glossy, the average publicity photo of a rock group always shows them with scowls on their faces, always shows them looking aloof, like they don't give a damn about anything, you know. So there are many more pictures of superstars today looking angry or bored than looking happy, delighted to see you, you know. So who knows, maybe that was a motivation too. So you know, I whatever it says about my hearing, I like the sound as well. I will admit that in the opening number of that lyric, "We are getting much too loud," interested me, because I had heard a lot of complaints about the sound. Michael, wasn't the sound tremendous? What was going on? You tell me, because I was confused if I was hearing a sound system thing or real actors at the back of the theater. Do you remember there was sound coming from the back of the theater? And
yes. Hosanna Superstar.
Yeah, right. That was a terrific effect, and I imagine it was sound system. I don't think they were back there, were they?
I don't think so. I have expected them to enter through the aisles for that.
Right.
For the Hosanna number afterwards, but they did not. I suspect that it was recorded, or, you know, maybe they were singing live backstage and just piped in from the back.
Yeah. I liked Chelina Kennedy much more than you did, because what I felt she was doing, and I Don't Know How to Love Him, was really delivering the lyric, that she was thinking about every word, and she wasn't delivering the pop hit. She really turned it into a musical theater scene. So I liked her very much in that, that she was...
That's interesting. I mean, I would say I agree with that, but I didn't really see... Then, I don't know, even in the previous number, I didn't really see love. I didn't see love there. I didn't.
Well, you know, he's a tough guy to love, you know. You know, I mean, that's the big flaw of this production for me. And I know it's the choice that they made. And but imagine this production could have been, because I like this production. Oh, by the way, I saw Josh Young, who I thought was sensational. I liked him quite a bit. At least I think I saw Josh Young. I didn't see any slip falling out of my program. I didn't see any thing on the call board. But you're right, Michael. He's missed a ton of performances.
Yeah,
so
far. Yeah.
You know, many too many. And, you know, this is one of those strange things where you hope, and I put quotation marks around the word hope, boldface quotation mark, where you hope he's really been sick. And I know it's a terrible thing to wish on anybody, but, you know, as opposed to, you know, him looking at his fingernail and saying, I don't think I'll go on today. You know, I mean, I don't know what's going on. But nevertheless, he's missed an inordinately large number of performances. So as a result, and it's too bad, because if indeed he is who I saw, and I really believe I did, he was terrific.
But let me tell you, Jeremy Kushner was amazing.
It's always wonderful when people see two performances and each claims the other one has to be superior.
I'm sorry. I don't mean to say
No. We all do that. It's great. It's one of the wonderful things about theater. You can't do that with the movies or TV. You know, you get one person and that's all there is to it. So it's a good thing. You know what also interests me about Jesus Christ Superstar? This is supposed to be this big new age thing when it came out, this this new world, new way of looking at musical theater, all that kind of business. And yet, Andrew Lloyd Webber and Tim Rice were not above the old convention that you can find in Pipe Dream, even, of reprising the songs late in the show to let people hear them again, the ones that they hope to become pop hits. Because you really do hear Everything's All Right, and I Don't Know How to Love Him again. Late in the show as reprises. So people say, yeah, that's a good song. I'm going to buy that single, you know, or I'm going to get the album, you know. So I found that very interesting. And here's my biggest nitpick of 2012, maybe of all time. And I just bring it up because it's kind of a curious thing. The show starts with the number 2012 on the electronic board. And it's really kind of nifty because then the number goes to 2011 all the way back to 33. And yes, Jesus died at 33, you know, so that sounds right. Actually, I don't understand this. I really don't. But scholars will tell you, I know this makes no sense, that Jesus was not born in the year zero. He was actually born in 4 BC. I don't know. I don't understand it either. How can Jesus be born 4 years before Christ, which BC is, that's what that means. But nevertheless, there must be some sort of calendar thing. But of course, up 29 in there, you know, it would have looked odd too. People say, what about 29? You can't win with that. But anyway, that's my biggest nitpick of the year. Anyway, I had a very good time with Jesus Christ Superstar. I have always loved the music since day one that I heard it. And I think it's being served very well vocally. So, but what it could have been if indeed we had a charismatic, you know, knock 'em out Jesus. Ah, I think it would have been one of the great shows of the millennium.
Yeah. You know what? I know this show very well, as I'm sure many of us do. I was involved in at least one production. And you know what? I never think I actually got until this time. I don't know if it was that they focused on it or maybe I was just paying more attention, but it's so interesting. The show was very controversial when it first opened for a number of reasons, but mostly because of the idea that Judas, who, I mean, the audience basically sees the story through Judas's eyes, and he constantly keeps saying about how Jesus is not the Son of God, and his perspective seems to be is that Jesus is this, you know, this great man, this leader, this do-gooder, who then and he was supporting him in that, and then at some point later on, Jesus began saying he was the Son of God, and Judas continually, you know, is incensed by and objects to this. So one might assume that the creators are saying that Jesus was not the Son of God. But the thing is, right before Judas's death, he's alone on stage and he sings the reprise of I Don't Know How to Love Him, which Peter just mentioned. And then he suddenly has these lines where he's sort of alone and like communing with God. And he says, oh my God, I've been tricked. I've been used. And you knew all the time. And I think one way to interpret that is that he suddenly realizes that that Jesus is in fact the Son of God, and that he has been used as the catalyst for Jesus's being martyred. Does everyone know this?
It's funny because that is something that I've always assumed was the case. I think so, Michael. I think that's what's meant there. We could both be wrong, but that's what I've always taken from it.
Well, then, in that case, I guess maybe a lot of people missed that, because most of the objection to the show that I've heard over the years is, from Christians saying that it's saying that Jesus was not the Son of God. But I think and of course it's not 100% clear, but I think that's what that moment means. I really think that's what it is.
Boy, it's very easy to find on the internet pictures of opening night back in 1971 of just 51st Street teeming with protesters,
yes,
with signs about the show happening. I mean, it really was. I remember. I never saw the original Broadway production in 1971.
Oh, I did. Mark Helm.
Yeah, well, if I had lived here, I would, I never did. Yeah, I had 2 years to do it, I'll grant you, but nevertheless, I just never did. And it's one of the things I really regret, because Tom O'Horgan certainly must have given it quite a visual sense. I know people loved it and hated it. So what did you do, Michael? Did you like it or hate it back then?
Oh, I loved it. Yeah, it was very over the top in its way, but every production I've seen has been in one way or another. It was quite something. I remember that. I vividly remember all that coverage, and I actually remember asking to go see it. And my father said something to the effect of, "I don't know if you want to go see that because I hear that it's a mockery." That was the publicity that was, and even just the title alone, people.
Yeah.
That's right. Yeah.
But it's funny how over the years things change and people have different perspectives and people get used to it. And I'm told that a lot of religious groups are going to.
I believe it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I believe it. Yeah. A lot can happen in 40 years.
Yeah. When many groups choose to do Jesus Christ Superstar, it's usually around Easter, and they count on a lot of religious groups to come in there, especially youth religious groups to come in to see the show. Michael had mentioned in the beginning of his discussion that there was an apprehension about going into this. I do hear that from various people throughout the community, that there is an apprehension. I don't really know anything about this show, but I'm afraid it's going to be a disaster. And then Peter talks about the protesters. We should have had protesters at the revival of Jesus Christ Superstar when it was at the Ford Center. That was
yes.
That was terrible, terrible production.
Protesting
so,
the quality of the
show. This one's much better.
And so, and that's and that's the general consensus from folks who have seen it, is that it is a much better. Better production. So let's move forward on up the block, and we'll ease on down the road up to City Center, where Pipe Dream is playing. And Peter got a chance to see that. So, and Michael's going to go this afternoon. So, Peter, tell us what you thought.
Michael, you're in for a very dull afternoon, I'm sorry to say. I don't think there's ever been a show written by major people that turned out as bad as this. I mentioned this to a friend who said, well, Irving Berlin's Mr. President. You know, it's not the same thing, because Berlin had been away for 9 years, and he wasn't responsible for the whole thing. But this one's really bad in terms of the show itself.
Right.
Rodgers and Hammerstein really had no business doing this show, in the sense that it just wasn't right for them, or especially for Oscar Hammerstein. The famous expression that Billy Rose said, the problem is that Oscar Hammerstein has never been in a whorehouse. And it really is true that it suffers for that, because everything is so genteel. And it really turns out to be a phenomenal problem, because everything is so genteel. It deals with a very slight story, very slight. It's basically, you know how you always hear in Oklahoma, gee, it's all about whether or not Laurie's going to go to the social.
Yeah.
Here, I mean, really, it's almost, are these two people ever going to be able to go on a date? A date! I'm serious. I mean, the first act ends with there being on a date, and it comes down to no particular tension. I mean, at least Oklahoma, you know, you have Judd Fry, you know, in the mix, which really makes a phenomenal difference. And, you know, all of us get chills at the end of the first act when Judd shows up and says, let's go. And, you know, she realizes what happens when you tease a man, you know, and you play one against the other because you think it's fun. And now suddenly here's the moment of reckoning. There's nothing like that in Pipe Dream, because the point is that Susie, the woman in question, is a drifter and somebody who's never found herself, all that kind of business. And the person who may be interested in her is this scientist who, who basically takes women home for a night and leaves it at that. That is established at the beginning. But they live across, the laboratory is across the street from the whorehouse. So, but it's very interesting that when Susie comes in, she's this real tough cookie. You know, she's been around and she wants to in fact, the reason she comes in is because she's tried to break, she succeeded even in breaking a window of a bakery because she was going to steal buns out of the window because she's hungry.
Like Jean Valjean.
So, yes, right, right. You know, so she's, right. Yeah, believe me, Les Mis is a better show than this one. Anyway, her hand is cut, and that's why they bring her to Doc, who's a PhD, not a medical doctor. But anyway, and she's snarky and quip, and everything's lousy. And so that's the type of person she is. Fine. So when she refers to the place across the street, you know, you would think that she would call it a cat house, you know, because she's been around, you know, and she's really a brass tacks lady. And she refers to it as the place across the street where the lights are still on. You know, now that's a euphemism if I ever heard one. That's pretty dainty, you know. So I think that's really an indication of how the show really fails right away to really be gritty. Now, to be fair, it's 1955. It's the Eisenhower era. You know, the sexual revolution hasn't happened yet. It would be almost to the day, 25 years, that the Best Little Whorehouse in Texas would be able to take advantage of that. And to be fair, supposedly it was a grittier show when it tried out in New Haven and Boston. But especially in Boston, which was a very prudish town at that time, you know, people were scandalized. I don't know how. I mean, what I mean is by I don't know how, I don't know what specifically offended them. I don't know what was changed, you know, so one has to take that in consideration. Musically, one has to take into consideration, too, that Richard Rodgers was not well. He was going through a cancer of the jaw, and certainly that puts a crimp on your creative activities. But the thing is, it is impossible to understand how these guys, A, started this project, B, continued with this project, C, finished this project, and D, decided it was stage worthy. It makes no sense whatsoever. So many of the songs really sound like minor league versions of songs they had done better. There's a much minor league version of a song, There Is Nothing Like a Dame. You really feel that when the guys start talking about women at one point while they're singing. But my God, There Is Nothing Like a Dame is so much better with so much more wit to it. So, but really, it's all about these two people and whether or not they'll get together. It's a very small story, and the best musicals, as we know, are big characters and big events. And these are not big characters. These are not big events. And it's so interesting, too, that when you actually get into the whorehouse, you hear a waltz for a song called The Happiest House on the Block. And it's the morning after the activities that happened the night before. And you even hear that the guys who came there were boring. I mean, it'd be interesting if they were kinky. You know, but again, 55, you know, what could you, but again, why did they do it? Why did they do it?
Well, I just read two things that were interesting. Apparently, supposedly, Hammerstein softened the piece as he was writing it. I guess sure. Presumably he couldn't quite bring himself to write about, you know, a whorehouse.
I mean, even little things like she says, the madam, business is off at my place. You know, I mean, it's even like, God forbid, it could be a place that's teeming with activity. It's like business is off seems to imply, you know, people don't go there. They don't want to go there. They shouldn't go there. It seems right. Almost like a moral judgment. You know, I mean, so that's a lot of stuff like that. Even the men, the townies are so naive. You know, they mix liquors together to see how they taste, you know, that type of thing. You know, serious drinkers, you know, would know better, but you know, that type of thing, you know, so it's by the way, nice presentation at Encores. Yeah. Everybody's fine. Leslie Uggams is a vast improvement on Helen Trouble. Helen Trouble, terrible performance. The original cast album is truly, 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 truly painful because here is the Wagnerian opera star who doesn't want you to forget that she has this big operatic voice and she can do this. She can do this with her two of her vocal cords tied together. She really wants to make that point. And again, notice they even chose a classy lady to run the brothel. So as if to say, you know, we're not getting down and dirty. Now, this is no reflection on Leslie Uggams, but at least she plays the character, you know, and she sounds better. So there is going to be a recording, albeit a live one. It's not going to go into the studio. They're just going to record one of the performances or all of them and mix them together. I don't know. But anyway, there will be a recording and it will come out better. You know, years ago, 20 years ago or so, they would talk about doing this as a Muppet show, seriously, with Miss Piggy is in the Harold and Trouble role. And there was a demo that was made where the score sounds much better. It's just with piano. Mary Testa played the role, and Judy Blazer played Susie. And they only did about 9 songs, but it's such a lovely recording. Just terrific, and the score has never sounded better. Oh, you know, it really is good, seriously. The best thing about this production, and this won't surprise you if you've been to Encores, but it's especially true in this one, the overture and the entr'acte. Boy, does that band sound great, I'll tell you. That orchestra really plays it, and you really lick your lips saying, oh, this is going to be great, it's going to be redeemed and all that. But then the show starts in a laboratory, which is not a musical place. So there's talk about ova and sperm, and you know, Sondheim always talks about why musicals. Why musicalize this? You know, this is a what were they thinking musical. And so any of you out there who are not seeing Pipe Dream because the run's too short or you're not in New York, don't beat yourself up too much about it. I mean, it would not be long while you were sitting there before you'd say, why am I here?
Well, word came this week that they are recording the show live.
Yeah.
So people, you know, will at least have that if they choose.
Sure.
To. It's interesting. When I read that, I was like, oh, what a great idea. The word is that the first several, a lot of the Encores shows were recorded in the first few years of the series' existence. And then they completely stopped, supposedly because the normal rule for a Broadway show, I believe, mm-hmm. is that each cast member receives, is it a week or 2 weeks pay?
Yeah,
one week for one day.
Yeah.
Well, I think that had been waived for Encores early on, and then for whatever reason, the Musicians Union or whatever it
Chicago
or Equity, I should say, was that was changed, and so it became prohibitively expensive for them to record the shows. But I wonder if this is the first time anyone thought of doing it live, and if maybe presumably they worked out some kind of special deal with Equity for that reason, rather than having to bring everybody into a studio. If that's the case, I mean, it's sad to think of all the Encores shows that were not commercially recorded,
sure,
that
sure.
could have been recorded live. So I wonder, maybe I'll ask someone about
that. Don't misunderstand me. I'm very glad this recording is happening, but I am one of the people. Not everybody shares this, and I understand this is just a personal feeling. I don't much like live recordings, and I'm not talking about the sound either, because the sound's a little bit less good than in a studio recording. I just don't like hearing the applause. It's something that doesn't interest me. And again, this may be heresy to many of the people who are listening here, who there are many people who prefer live recordings because the excitement of being there, you know, and I understand that point of view. I really do. It's just for me, I want to hear the music and lyrics at their best. So I like the little bit of boost you get from the sound quality. And frankly, the applause starts bothering my ears after a while. It's a sound that I just don't want to hear on a record.
Peter, given the given what people are saying about Pipe Dream, perhaps the applause won't be a problem with the recording.
No, that's frankly, at my performance on Thursday night, there were the applause was quite polite, and I will say this: the applause was certainly stronger than the laughs the lines were getting that was supposed to be hilarious. So, it may have been the most tepid response of any show that I've attended at Encores. That said, I'm still glad it happened. You know, we need to know why these things are good or bad. You know, why they worked, why they didn't. We need those questions answered. So bless Encores for doing this. I mean, we've really got to the point now where Encores does one really obscure title a year. I mean, you can say, well, Merrily ran far fewer performances than Pipe Dream. Yeah, but Merrily is a far more famous show and a far more beloved show for all its flaws, and a show that gets done constantly.
Right.
And certainly Gentlemen Prefer Blondes has a history and a movie and all that kind of business. So, it is true that people tend to go to Encores when they're more famous shows than less famous shows. And I'll bet the attendance for the other two shows was substantial. For Merrily was, and Gentlemen Prefer Blondes will be, substantially higher, more tickets sold than for Pipe Dream. So this is their one a year now. It used to be three a year. Were obscure. Now it's one.
My apologies if you guys had mentioned this already. I don't think I heard it. Are there many recordings of Pipe Dream already?
Just one.
So, and it's perhaps, you know, Rodgers and Hammerstein has stepped in and said, let's make a recording of this to market the show.
Presumably.
Well, I was speaking
because,
to Chip before this all happened, when the show was in rehearsal, and he said, gee, I hope we get an album out of it. So it was certainly a hope of his, and I'm sure he did everything he could to make it easily happen. Well, I guess in time we'll find out who's the one who said, you know, if we do it live, we'll save a bundle. You know, somebody obviously came up with that, and I don't know if it was Ted, who's the president of R&H, or somebody else entirely, but nevertheless, if this is the way it's got to be, fine with me.
I'm pretty sure that, you know, after you mentioned that to Ted, Ted's like, Felicia says it's a go.
Yeah, right. That's exactly
so
what happens.
Ted's
right.
like, Peter wants yes. one, we got to do it.
That better be in the liner notes, right? That's yeah, right. sure.
I was talking with Peter Felicia, and he said he'd like to have a recording of Pipe Dream, so we decided to pull the trigger and pony up $500,000.
Frankly, Ted's the one who gave me the one with Judy Blazer and Mary Tester, and 20 years ago when it was happening. I mean, it was on cassette even. I bless him for that, because that was the first time I really, really liked the score. The albums, in 1965, RCA released 10 old show albums. That was the first time there was ever really a reissue program. And three of them were Allegro, Me and Juliet, and Pipe Dream, the three failures that Rodgers and Hammerstein did. And those were the first three I bought. And, you know, I liked a lot of Allegro. I liked less of Me and Juliet and far less of Pipe Dream still. But that has to do because it really is a brittle sounding recording. Mm. And that's the word I want, brittle.
Yeah.
And it's just not an inviting album. The singing on it is very arch for both Helen Trouble and is William Johnson, is that his name, the guy who plays Doc, whoever he may be. It was a part that Henry Fonda, they wanted, imagine. Judy Tyler, the woman who played Susie in the original production, what a fascinating career she had, because by the age of 20, you know, you heard that line about Evita, she did it all by 26, whatever that lyric is.
Yeah.
Judy Tyler did it all by 23. She was a TV star to children everywhere by playing Princess Summer, Fall, Winter, Spring on Howdy Doody. Now, that was an iconic, famous, important TV show. The kids' TV show in the 50s. All right. Then she was in a Rodgers and Hammerstein musical, and then she was in Jailhouse Rock with Elvis Presley. How many people can say they were on an iconic TV show, a movie with Elvis Presley, and a Rodgers and Hammerstein musical, and then got killed in a car crash in Wyoming when she was 23? I mean, God almighty, what a story. Wow. And she on the album sounds very plaintive. I like the way she sounds. But, you know, Michael, you know the album?
I was just listening to it a little the other day. It's one of those things I've had for years, and I think I
okay.
I think now, I put it on once and then just kind of.
All right. Now, here you are listening to that song, her opening song, where she sings Everybody's Got a Home But Me.
Right.
And she's talking about the fact that she's traveling by bus around the country, and she sees people, two lovers on a porch, you know, getting along and how wonderful. She sees scenes of families and homes and how wonderful that is, and she realizes everybody's got a home but me. Fine, it's a nice song, nothing wrong with it. But would you have expected, Michael, would you have expected that she sings it to somebody? I mean, I was convinced when I first heard that song that this was an interior monologue. She just delivered it to the audience and nobody else was around, that she would finally let that go. She comes on as such a tough cookie, and suddenly she's opening up to somebody she's just met. I'm telling you, there's nothing about this show that works. Kill it.
Well, I got to interview Laura Osnes for Broadway Stars. Maybe we can put the link to it. And it's just interesting to hear what she had to say about how, she said that, in the original version of in the book by Steinbeck, who apparently was very unhappy with the musical.
Yeah, yeah.
There's no bones about the fact that Susie is a prostitute. And I said, well, so are you using that as your backstory? And she said, Laura said, well, I'm playing Susie as if she probably has done that in the past, but she's mostly just a homeless girl bumming away from town to town. No money, no job, no family. I think I mentioned, I actually saw a production of Pipe Dream, and I could not even remember exactly when or where it was. That's how little impression the show made on me. But I actually emailed Bert Fink, who also works for Rodgers and Hammerstein, and he reminded me it was at Hofstra University, and I guess it was about 10 years ago, 1992.
That's interesting you say that, because I saw one in 91, but it was somewhere on the Far East Side. It was almost like on FDR Drive.
Oh, really?
And it was in a very strange looking building. I've never been in it before or since. So suddenly, Michael, 92 is 20 years ago, not 10. But time goes. It does.
God, that's frightening.
You got to learn, whenever you say, I bet it was 4 years ago, just double it and you'll be right. You know what I mean? That's the way it is with time. You
I
know,
can't
so,
believe it was 20 years. Well, I'm going to have to
face it. Face it. By the way, Laura Osnes, good for her. She's going to be playing Maria in The Sound of Music, a much better Rodgers and Hammerstein show, I don't care what anybody says, at Carnegie Hall on April 24th or so. So good for her. She's working.
Yeah, I wanted to mention that there are so few people in the business as nice and as talented and knowledgeable as Ted Chapin is.
That's nice. Yeah.
Such an amazing giving person. We should see if we can rally him on a Sunday morning to come on.
And Bert Fink, too.
And Bert Fink is, yeah.
People.
Has got some wonderful people in the organization.
Mm-hmm. Bruce Pomahap. Great guy. Sure. does the musical restoration and did a lot of work on this pipe dream.
Do a Rodgers and Hammerstein morning and see if we can get them.
Why not? Oh, what a beautiful morning that would be. Yes.
Oh, exactly.
I'm for that.
Exactly. Well, let's move forward on from City Center, and we'll go just a little bit left over to, or west, I should say, over to Lincoln Center, where Michael got to see Magnon. Is that the correct pronunciation of it?
Well, Magnon.
Magnon, yeah. At the Metropolitan Opera. And Michael, quickly tell us about that production.
Well, the most interesting thing about this production for musical theater fans, I would say, is the fact that the cast contains not one but two people who played Emile Debec in the Lincoln Center beautiful production of South Pacific. Paolo Schott plays the father of the central character of Manon Lescaut, and David Pitzinger plays the father of the principal male role, the Count de Grieux. So it was so much fun to see them both on stage together at the Met, you know, and to hear them. They both have, you know, serious, legit opera voices, and they had, I believe, both had opera careers before they even went to South Pacific, so it's not like stunt casting by any means. And they both really filled it, that 3,800 seat theater with no problem, singing over an 80 piece orchestra. It's so great to go to the Met and hear live music with that kind of an orchestra with no amplification. One of, you know, relatively few places where you can experience that anymore. I kind of hated the production. it's by Laurent Pelly.
I didn't see that coming.
Yeah, the production itself, again, musically, it was spectacular. Anna Netrebko, who is got one of the most amazing voices in the history of the world, is Manon Lescaut. And she just, I'm amazed to say, I think it was the first time I'd actually heard her live. And obviously, to hear an opera singer live, that's when you really know what the fuss is all about. She's a gorgeous woman and a wonderful actress, and the voice is beyond spectacular. The tenor was equally great. I don't actually know how to say this name. It's Piotr, the Russian version of Peter Bezala, Bezala. But the production is by Laurent Pelly, and it's very, very postmodern and silly things like, I really continue to hate subtext being played over on the top, as Gerard Alessandrini says in one of his most memorable Forbidden Broadway numbers. There's a scene where, I won't go on too long, but Manon is actually kind of a reprehensible character. She supposedly loves this man greatly, but she just cannot give up creature comforts. So she leaves him, you know, in order to live with a rich guy and live in the lap of luxury. And so fine, she leaves him. He then goes to become a priest because he's so destroyed by the whole thing. And then she hears that and she goes to the chapel to seduce him, basically, just because to know that she can. And so then they get back together again for a little while, but then her drinking and her sexual escapades and her love of money cause problems, and then they get separated again, and then she winds up dying. She has a bad end. So I guess the piece is moralistic in that sense. She certainly doesn't thrive or anything. But anyway, in the scene where she goes to the chapel to seduce him, they actually had a bed on stage. In the chapel. I mean, yes, it was off to the side. I guess you were supposed to think it was his room off of the chapel. That didn't work because there were people singing to him, you know, and communicating with him from the the chapel part of the set. So that they, if that's what they were trying to establish, that didn't work at all. And also that at the end, the act ends with this amazingly gorgeous love duet. And in this case, they fell into the bed together and she ripped his shirt off, you know, just to make it clear what's happening. But really the singing was great. The orchestra was fantastic. I ran into, Steve Ross, who's a wonderful veteran cabaret and nightclub performer, and right at the intermission, right after that scene I was just talking about, and he said, "It's so wonderfully sexual." He said, "Nobody does it like the French." And I said, "Yes, that's certainly true." But I mean, I think he was referring to the writing more than the production. I did not read this production opened earlier last week, I believe. I missed the reviews. I'm going to have to catch up and see what other people thought of it. But my take is infuriating production, beautiful singing and orchestra playing.
Well, Michael, you might not have to catch up with those reviews right away, or read them per se. One of our listeners, Erica Sweeney, had emailed us about this wonderful podcast called Opera Now, which she equated to the opera version of This Week on Broadway. And I took a listen to it, and it was very enjoyable. And I'm not a big opera person, but I really enjoyed the podcast. So if you are an opera person or enjoy podcasts, check out the Opera Now podcast. I'll link to it in our show notes. And perhaps they will talk about this production and give you the lowdown on what they're thinking there. Also, Erica had an interesting postscript on her email to us. Peter, did you address that? Erica said that according to Wikipedia, Mr. Felicia has appeared on Saturday Night Live. So tell us, is Wikipedia incorrect or did you actually appear?
No, I don't know who put that on Wikipedia, but it is true. Back in the early 80s, I was standing in the TKTS booth line with a friend from Boston who was getting tickets. I was just keeping him company when suddenly a crew came in and said, coming through Saturday Night Live. We need to set up our cameras here. And the line went crazy. Everybody said, we're going to be on Saturday Night Live. This is going to be great. You know, and it took them a long time to set up. And to the point of which really people started talking, they even forgot they were there. So anyway, finally the person turns around and says, "Okay, who wants to be on Saturday Night Live?" And seriously, I remember it so vividly. I had enough time to look to my left and look to my right. And everybody was frozen in fear, and I slowly put up my hand. So they came out and they said to me, "Okay, who do you hate?" Well, the first thing that came to mind, I had been in Boston the day before, and I was with my very best friend in the world, who I love dearly, who sat next to me at Sherry's Skyscraper and Holly Golightly. I mean, we've been friends forever. However, politically, we don't see eye to eye at all. He's very right wing, and I'm not. So anyway, he had on his talk radio, and there was a guy in Boston at the time named Jerry Williams, who was just this horrible muckraker. I couldn't stand him, and I thought about him. However, I knew that if I mentioned Jerry Williams, a Boston DJ, I wouldn't get on the show. Now, ironically enough, when my friend was driving me to the airport, Jerry Williams had on Donny Osmond, who was in Boston at the time doing the tryout of Little Johnny Jones. And I said, "Oh my God, you know, it isn't bad enough we have Jerry Williams, now we have Donny Osmond too. Oh my God." So I thought about Donny Osmond. I said, "You know, I hate Donny Osmond. I just can't stand him. I think he looks like a mutant. I can't stand his voice. I want to see Little Johnny Jones, but I don't want to see Donny Osmond. So I'm going to call the theater every day and say, when's the understudy going on? And when that happens, I am going to go see Little Johnny Jones." Well, Saturday night comes, And that was a Tuesday. Saturday night comes, and as it turned out, Linda and I were having this enormous party. At that time, Alex Cohen had this big event called Night of a Thousand Stars, Night of 100 Stars, sorry. Yeah. Uh-huh. And we had a party called Night of 100 Friends. We invited literally 100 friends, and we had this enormous party at an art gallery, and it was a great event. So we come home, you know, like 1 o'clock in the morning, and there are 7 messages on the answering machine, and, you know, I'm really scared. You know, I really thought something had happened to my mother, you know, something like that, because after all, who's calling on a Saturday night? And it was 7 people calling from Boston or Baltimore or out of town, you know, saying, we just saw you on Saturday Night Live. So they used it. Now, here's the interesting thing to me. You be the judge of it. I got a phone call from Fred Nathan, who was the press agent of the show, who chewed me out for saying this about Donny Osmond on TV. I was amazed that the press agent didn't use his press agent resources and say, ah, this is great. You know what we're going to do? We're going to take you to the show. We're going to take you backstage. You know, you're going to do a big thing, you know, and, you know, we'll have you say, ah, was it? I take it back. Donny Osmond was phenomenal, you know, so on and so forth. And I was amazed that he took that tack as opposed to using it. I mean, this is national publicity. Yeah. I mean, you know, Little Johnny Jones was not a sensation at the box office. It would run all of 1 official performance. It closed on opening night. So I would think they could have used all the publicity they could get. And really, what kind of press agent doesn't take this catnip and run with it and say, ah, wow, what a story this is going to be. So that was my Saturday Night Live story. ironically enough, I have since heard that episode no longer exists. It was Sid Caesar was the host, and he had such fights with Lorne Michael. Lorne Michael found him very difficult that supposedly he destroyed the tape after the show. So I don't know if that's true, but that's what I've heard. So,
I'm shocked that Sid Caesar is difficult. I've never heard that before.
I'm not saying this is true. I'm only saying I've heard, you know, but this is what somebody told me. So if you weren't there on that night, the Saturday before Little Johnny Jones opened and closed, then you'll never see me on Saturday Night Live.
All right. Next up, Peter went to go see The Big Meal. Peter, why don't you tell about this? The Playwrights Horizons, is that correct?
Yeah, boy, it's terrific. It's only 85 minutes long, and it deals with decades of life in a family, starting with a pickup, really. A guy's at a restaurant, and he talks to the waitress, and they start talking, and eventually they get together, and both of them agree, no relationship, nothing like that. Don't need it, through with that, you know, taking time off. We're not going to get serious. And then you see the marriage and the kids and their kids' marriages and their kids and so on and so forth. And what this little bit of interaction between two people can lead to. It's a show that ultimately comes to the conclusion, not unlike Company, that it's something you got to do. It's worth it. It's worth it to go through the family situation, to have children with all the pain it brings, with all the chaos that marriage gives. Nevertheless, it is an achievement. And it's something that human beings can be proud of. So it does end on that note, but good Lord. You know, while you're watching it, you really are taken back to all those horrible, you know, experiences you've had at family dinners. You do see family dinners' worst nightmares, and we've all had them. I mean, somebody once sent me a card that said, friends are God's apology for relatives. And that's essentially underlined here in this play, that you have to deal with relatives, the cantankerous father who you have to placate at every meal, and you got to make sure you don't say the wrong thing, so on and so forth. And that's what happens generation after generation. Taking kids to a restaurant, and what, James, I don't have to tell you, I'm sure. I mean, you have little kids. I mean, you know, sit down, sit still. Don't do that. No, you're not eating that. You know, all that kind of business. It really reiterates the human condition. It shows it at its worst. It's very painful, and yet it's very funny because the audience was roaring because we've all been there, and we're all going to be there again, and we all hate the fact that we have to get together for so-and-so's birthday on days we don't feel like it. You know, a friend of mine says one of the things he hates about buying subscriptions to theaters, you know, that you get your tickets, you're going to go on February 19th and March 26th and April 3rd, you know, that type of thing. When you that night actually arrives, you might not feel like going out, and you got to go out because you bought the ticket. Well, the birthdays roll around for these people. The Thanksgiving rolls around. You may not feel like seeing these people. You may not feel like being with these people. You may not feel like going out. You've had a tough time that day, that week. You just need some rest. But you got to do it. There's no way out. These are mandatory appearances that you must make. And that's what the big meal reiterates, how difficult it is to deal with our families. And whether or not you buy at the end that it's all worth it, just as much as do you buy at the end that Bobby really feels that he needs to commit to feel alive. It's a good question, but it's very entertaining because the playwright gets it right. He makes it real, and it's a rare human being who won't identify with much, if not all, of the big meal. It's at the Small Spaces Playwrights Horizons upstairs. I will be astonished if we don't see it again. This is a play that must move. I think it can really be a staple in community theater because it has wonderful roles, because people have to play different generations. And how wonderful for Anita Gillette. It was funny, I was just writing about Anita Gillette because I was writing about All American, the musical, the Charles Strauss, Lee Adams show from 1962, which after all, 1962, it celebrated its 50th anniversary, and she was the ingenue there. Well, here, of course, she plays the grandmother and plays it extraordinarily well, and reminding us that she wasn't just a musical comedy person. She was the original cast member of Chapter 2, playing the wife, Judd Hirsch's wife in Chapter 2. So she's no stranger to non-musical roles, and she certainly seems very much at home here. And I was delighted the other day when I was with the Lucille Lortel nominators, and we gave out our nominations, that there was no problem securing Anita Gillette a nomination. So that was nice. So I highly recommend The Big Meal. I hope it extends. I hope it moves. I hope it becomes a classic. It deserves it.
Well, I'm sure that now that they've heard you weigh in on it, they will. Ted Chapin will jump on the phone and say, okay. You know.
That sounds really amazing, Peter. Thank you for I did make a note of it because aside from everything else, I always love to see Anita on stage. So I'm going to have to really try. Oh, and by the way, if I could correct my misspeaking before, the production of Pipe Dream that I saw was in 2002, not 1990.
Ah, so it was 10 years ago.
Yeah. So I don't know what I was saying, but...
The Big Meal is at the PDJ Sharp Theater, and it's been extended through April 22nd, so you still have a few weeks to catch it.
This is one of my pet peeves, I'm sorry. Mm-hmm. Did I mention this before? There are literally about 8 Peter J. Sharp theaters in the city.
Really?
Yes. This is one of those foundations or one of those families that, you know, it's very, very wonderful and generous for them to give so much money. But I think it's confusing to have more than one theater, you know, and let alone 5 or 6 or 7 or 8 named Peter J. Sharp. So just to clarify, the location of this one is on 42nd Street, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, at Playwrights Horizons.
I always wondered why the theater on West 55th Street and 9th Avenue was called Theater 4. You know, I mean, where's the 4th come in? You know, I mean, you know, 55th and 9th. Where's Theater 4? I mean, you know, so I imagine it's by a guy who owned 3 others, and this was his 4th theater. But yeah, so that's
If you Google it, you'll be amazed. It's there's one at I think there's one at Juilliard. I can't actually remember, but I know for a fact that there are several. And wow. I know that's caused problems for people in the past in terms of being confused as to where they were going. So,
yeah, it seems like it's one up at Lincoln Center, and there's Playwrights Horizons on 42nd, and there's Symphony Space,
yes.
And yeah, Google is your friend. All righty. So this is the one at Playwrights on 42nd Street. So check that out. In fact, it's a good opportunity for us to say that if, in fact, you were going to look for the correct Peter J. Sharp Theater to see The Big Meal, you could go to the show notes at BroadwayRadio.com. And in the show notes, you'll see all of our information there, links to various different things. We actually have a video from The Big Meal that's on the page there if you want to see a scene from it. Also, there's contact information for Peter, Michael, and myself there. So if you want to send us an email or give us a call or check us out on Facebook or Twitter or something else, all the information is there, as well as a catalog of all of our previous discussions about our experiences on This Week in Broadway. If you would like to subscribe, you can also subscribe to the podcasts by going to that show page, and there'll be a subscribe link for iTunes. You can get us through different various ways, through Stitcher, which is an application for your smartphone, or you can listen to us on Broadway World Radio. Broadway World plays us Wednesdays at noon, Thursdays at 7 p.m., and Saturdays at 2 p.m. And if you would, we still have on the top of the page there the Broadway Radio survey, which will help us understand who is listening better so that we can approach advertisers and say these are the type of people that are listening to our show, and no personal information is given there. So we don't actually, you know, we're not actually tracking you. We're just trying to find out, you know, what the typical listener to our podcast is what they're like. So there was a few things that happened in the news this week. We'll go through them very quickly because we are running very late. First of which is that there's discussion that Merrily We Roll Along, and not the recent production here in New York, but in Cincinnati, a John Doyle production where everybody's playing their instruments, may come to Broadway. Michael and Peter, do you have 10 seconds to say about this?
I almost saw it. I was there a week too early, so I would have had a much better opinion of that, but I'll take any Merrily I can get.
Absolutely.
I did get to see the John Doyle company when it started out there before it came to Broadway, and that was very exciting. I do think that the actors playing musicals thing is I personally don't think it's outworn its welcome if it's done well, which he has done at least twice that I've seen with Company and Sweeney Todd. So I don't object to that at all. I am a little. I mean, I saw Malcolm Getz plays Frank in this production, and he did it at the York Theater a number of years ago. And I, aside from everything else, I don't know. I think in order for Merrily to work, I think there's a general opinion nowadays that you have to cast people who are just at the right age where they're believable, where they can believably play from 20 to 40, basically, with the help of some makeup. And I just don't know if Malcolm Getz can play, you know, a 20-year-old at this point. I'm a big fan of his, but that sounds, and for that matter, Becky Ann Baker, who plays Mary, I would say the same thing very much applies to her as well. And also, I think that she has gotten some less than great reviews, particularly in terms of her singing. So if it does come, I wonder if they'll keep the cast, all of the cast. That would be interesting to see.
All right. Also is that Carrie is getting a quote-unquote recording.
No, it is not.
You know, I don't see
misleading
the point.
Headlines there.
Yeah, I don't see the point of a misleading press release that says, you know, carried to receive first official recording, and then it turns out that it's being taped for the archives, so that Lincoln Center, isn't that right?
Center Library, Lincoln Center Archive. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So we won't see that being released on iTunes. At least I don't think it. We will be, but.
No.
Interesting there. Before, when we were talking about Jesus Christ Superstar, I meant to bring up that Tim Rice had an interview in The Guardian, and he talks about his collaboration with Andrew Lloyd Webber about definitely being something, a thing of the past, and won't happen again in the future, which is sad for all of us who have held out the thought that possibly these two greats would get back together and just put out one more hit for us. Anything to say about this?
Well, yeah, it reminds me of Jerry Buck and Sheldon Harnick, who split and about 40 years later got together to write a song, and it wasn't one of their best. Collaboration's a funky thing, no question about it. And when it's working, it's wonderful. But I think after a while, when two people drift apart, just as in relationships, it's just very hard to get them back together and get that old feeling back. So I don't know if they got back together, if we would have work commensurate with the work they did originally. I think it may be too much to ask. So this may be moot.
And it has been pointed out that many people seem to feel that what happened with Andrew Lloyd Webber is that he got to a point where he actually, it sounds ridiculous, but that he wanted to work with lyricists who weren't especially talented, so that he could be like the absolute unquestioned star of the show, rather than, you know, having an actual collaboration. I think many of us would say that nothing he has written after his collaboration with Tim Rice is equal to those, basically those three shows that everyone knows: Jesus Christ Superstar, Joseph and the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat, and Evita. So I mean, that's one interpretation of it. I don't know if that's the reason why they broke up, but I do think that it's that Lloyd Webber has not grown since that time, whereas Tim Rice, at least, you know, he Chess was a really terrific collaboration with the guys from ABBA, and then he wrote, of course, lyrics to Aladdin, and was there one or two other animated films like that?
Yeah,
yeah. I mean, it's probably good in a way. One interesting sidelight is they did get back together long enough to write the song "You Must Love Me" for the film of Evita, which now apparently is included in the Broadway current Broadway revival. So that's probably a testimonial or whatever, to the last gasp of Webber and Rice see on Broadway.
Testimonial right now. To Cash.
Well, yes, a testimonial for Cash, and isn't it interesting what that lyric is? You must love me, and neither one of them apparently loves each other enough to continue working. So,
certainly, I agree. We mentioned this a couple of weeks ago, that with Tim Rice's horror at the fact that a reality show is going to be used to pick the star of the upcoming London revival of Jesus Christ Superstar. He calls it tacky and relentlessly down market to do it that way, and I as a tremendous anti fan of those shows, I completely agree with him on that.
All right, and I would be remiss if I did not mention that we are recording on April 1st, which in the States here, I don't know if is this an international thing or just a States thing. Is
I don't know. That's a
April
good point.
Fool's Day.
Oh, I don't know. That's a good question.
Is there an April Fool's musical that we can mention or play? I don't know of any April Fool's jokes in any plays, other than The Blonde and the Thunderbird. Was that on April 1st?
What is interesting is that Oklahoma opened on March 31st, and considering that everybody thought it was going to be a terrible show, I wonder if on April 1st, when the reviews came out, people reading them here, having heard the bad word of mouth out of town on the show, said, this must be an April Fool's joke. I've often wondered that. So,
our good friend Michael Dale over at Broadway World. I think Michael's been on the podcast before.
Yes,
Michael's
he
a great
has.
Guy.
Yeah. He wrote a column where Godspell is introducing a Kindle seat where producer Ken Davenport has allowed people to come into the theater. And this is not the April Fool's joke, but Ken Davenport
the first part is the true part. The
first part's the true part, where people come in and Ken has designated seats for tweeters to tweet throughout the performance. And Michael Dale's article proposes that that there is now a Kindle seat for people who want to come in and read their Kindle while during the show, because what's happening on stage is not compelling enough. So
I'm amazed Dave and Merrick never did anything with April Fool's Day. If he did, I never heard about it. Given the prankster that he was.
Well, David Merrick, every day was April Fool's Day.
I guess so, yeah.
You know, was it Subways Are Sleeping, where he brought in New Yorkers with the same names as the critics?
Yeah.
All righty. So
just to quickly bring this a little full circle, I urge any of you out there who love musical theater but have not gotten into opera to do so for several reasons. Because first of all, opera is great. The acting, I think, has improved vastly over the decades, even though there were always some people who were great actors. But my point here is that when you go to the opera at the Met, there is no eating or drinking of anything in the house. The audience, you know, with very, very rare exceptions, is completely silent. Will very, 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 very rarely hear a cell phone go off. And it's just, a wonderful return to a time when people were engaged in what was happening on stage rather than just satisfying whatever need they felt at the moment to talk or eat or drink or text or do whatever. So so if you want to find that, which is harder to find nowadays, the Met is definitely one place to find it.
All right. So with that note, I will sign off here by saying thank you all for listening to Broadway Radio's This Week on Broadway. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Thanks.